okay? Okay, so thank you, Jason, for that introduction. I have to confess that it's actually been 40 years that I've been working on semantics, but who's counting? And so what is semantics anyway? What
do...
Yeah, but I... No, but I started graduate school at the University of Texas in 1973. And immediately fell in love with semantics. So what is semantics? That's perhaps the question we should start with. This talk may not be quite as practical as Jason promised. This is from Stanley Fish. Just piling up words one after the other won't do much of anything until something else has been added. And this is from Anthony Burgess. And the words slide into the slots ordained by syntax and glitter as with atmospheric dust, with those impurities which we call meaning. And that's our quest, right? To figure out how to sprinkle these impurities over whatever it is the computer is doing with the input it sees. So how are we going to do that? So I'm going to talk about some of the challenges, some of these impurities. And I'll talk about AMRs and talk about the challenges that it is addressing and some of the challenges it is not addressing. So just to give a quick summary, and I think James did a wonderful job on Monday afternoon giving you lots of examples of these things, so I'm assuming that you're all now very familiar with it. But there are sense distinctions, there's semantic similarities that we want to capture, there's world knowledge that needs to be taken into account, there are metaphors and constructions and coercions and metonymies and implicit arguments and all kinds of things. Some of which, like I said, AMR actually has a good handle on, and some of which it doesn't. So just to start with sense distinctions, so here's a, can everybody read that? So here's one of my favorite cartoon strips. So up at the top, the waiter is saying to the two ladies, "I'm sorry, we only serve men in this room." And the ladies answer, "Good, bring us two." And of course, the humor here is in the ambiguity and how you interpret what serving men means. And in fact, this is truly a syntactic ambiguity rather than a sense distinction. It's the same meaning of serve. In the first one, the serve is the men are the indirect object. You're going to serve food to the men, but you could also say we're going to serve men food, so it's perfectly okay for men to be in the object position. And in the second one, the interpretation is that the men are the food that's being served. So it would be serve men to us. So here's some genuine sense distinctions. And these are the kind of sense distinctions that most machine translation systems should actually be able to get right, just based on the amount of context that they use in doing the word alignments. So Iraq lost the battle, and John lost his computer. You certainly wouldn't want to get that wrong. You wouldn't want to say that Iraq had misplaced the battle. But like I said, you know, this is the kind of thing that enough context does a pretty good job of handling. So here are some kind of sense distinctions that AMR is able to make. He calls me every day at 8 a.m. and 5 p.m. versus the Secretary of State Baker in a foreign policy speech called for the reunification of Germany. So the first one is sort of to communicate with someone via some sort of instrument or device, probably a telephone. Whereas the second one is, you know, he's kind of requesting the reunification of Germany. And AMR, because it uses the prop bank frame set IDs, will actually mark these. I mean, in fact, it does mark the first one as call 02 and the second one is call 03. Here's some, and those are also possibly things that machine translation systems can already handle. Maybe somebody who knows more about machine translation output might have a better feel for that than I have. Here are some that perhaps would be harder because the immediate context take out is the same for all of these examples. And the first one in particular, take out a pencil, take out an ad, is very productive. There's, you know, a very wide range of things that you could use that particular verb particle expression with. The second one is probably not even a verb particle constriction. It's probably actually a fixed expression. Take it out on her, as in take your anger out on her or on him. So the take it out on is probably really a fixed expression. But then take out the enemy, take the enemy out, that's a verb particle constriction. That looks an awful lot like take out a pencil or take a pencil out. But it's, you know, we certainly don't want to translate that the same way. And then this, you know, take out a year to go on vacation, to go to Tahiti, to sail around the world. Again, that's not the same thing as taking out the pencil or taking out the enemy. Now, these just happen to be, these are actually the prop bank frame set IDs for all of these. I was surprised to realize that prop bank was in fact giving you separate frame set IDs for, you know, these different expressions. Take as a verb in and of itself has 256 different multi-word expressions. This is over and above just the normal sense distinctions that, you know, you might expect to find with the verb. And here are just some examples. There are at least, so there's all the verb particle constructions, some of which we've captured. Then here's just a bunch. There's more than 40 of these, just, I guess there's 39. Just more or less fixed expressions, things that you can say with take that most native speakers of English wouldn't have any trouble understanding. And frankly, we're not at all sure what to do with in terms of, you know, annotating or not annotating or, yes, Jason.
So I wonder if some of these are at least partly compositional, like take home, which might be the bring sense of take, or take down, might be a resultative construction.
I think there are, take home is ambiguous, so there's the, I'm going to, you know, take my daughter home, which is perfectly compositional, but if you have a, you know, this is a, take home, you know, take it home as in bring it to fruition. Yeah, so yes, for most of these, there's quite often a, I mean, you could, if you're going to a pharmacy in Britain and you're talking about medication, the pharmacist might tell you to take this powder or take a powder for this ailment when they actually mean ingest the powder. Okay, but that's not the same thing. This take a powder is to leave.
Well, no argument on
so,
that one.
Yeah.
The taking a message home is one of these things that's partly compositional, right? In other words, you can see its compositional origins.
You could say it's abstract or a metaphorical sort of slant on what was originally compositional, sure. Yeah, and that's true for a lot of these, but it's just a little bit daunting to try to figure out how to deal with all of them. Some of them, quite a few of these, we have a whole paper on this, and quite a few of them we do deal with by just associating them with a kind of more compositional sense entry and saying, you know, something about how it gets handled. So one of the other things that we do, in fact, in trying to handle these things, is to group them with a sense that we think is very similar. And we've done this, in fact, with 2,500 WordNet entries, where we've just kind of grouped senses together that we think have a fairly coherent, common, semantic, compositional slant, shall we say. There we go. Okay. So here, the label sense, this would be, I called my son Derek. They called him a bastard. You can call me professor. You can call him sir. Those are four different senses in WordNet, and we've grouped all of them together because they all talk about labeling somebody with some kind of thing. This is the call someone on the telephone or a radio or some sort of device. This would be visiting your relatives or a ship calling at a port, okay, making a visit. So you get the general idea. If you just try to train a word sense disambiguation system on data that's been annotated directly with WordNet senses, the best system performance you can get is about 65%, which is not going to do anybody very much good. But with these groupings, we can get much better inter-annotator agreement and can get pretty good performance up in the like 88, 89%. And so what we end up with is, so quite often what you'll find is that there'll be one prop bank frame set ID that maps, these are all the WordNet senses. The WordNet senses have been grouped into these four categories. But then there will be a whole lot of things that WordNet didn't include, like a lot of these multi-word expressions and verb particle expressions and things, like all of these things down here, some of which are in prop bank, some of which are not in prop bank. You know, so it's there's still a lot. It's not certainly not a solved problem, and we're hoping that all of this great work that's being done these days with distributional compositional semantics and induction of word senses and things like that can turn this kind of manual clustering into something that's much more automatic, and I don't have to spend another 40 years doing this kind of thing. So. In fact, what we get are the prop bank frame sets, which are the ones that AMR is actually annotating, are sort of a very your first most coarse grain cut at what you think the sense distinctions will be. The groupings give us something at a more intermediate level, and then there's WordNet is quite a bit more fine-grained. And then you get better inter-annotator agreement and better system performance as you get a more coarse-grained, just like you would expect. So we've mapped all of these groupings to VerbNet and FrameNet as well. We've extended VerbNet. We have type-to-type mapping from the PropBank frame sets to the VerbNet classes to the FrameNet frames. We have token-to-token mapping. We've taken the Wall Street Journal PropBank annotation and mapped it to the specific VerbNet instances, VerbNet classes, and the specific FrameNet frames with all the mappings to the thematic roles and the frame elements. You can treat either VerbNet class tagging or FrameNet frame tagging as a word sense disambiguation task, and you can get pretty good performance on that. And having the just like PropBank, the PropBank arguments can be very overloaded. Arg2 gets used in lots of very different verbs with very different meanings. But if we subdivide the ARG2 into subgroups based on the mapping to the VerbNet thematic roles that are more that are fairly coherent, we can actually improve the performance. So the performance on the Wall Street Journal corpus improves just on ARG2 6%. On the Brown corpus, which of course has a lot more novel data, it improves 10%. Okay, so that was just to give you an idea of what kind of sense distinctions AMR captures. So now let's talk about AMR in more detail. This is being developed by ISI, Colorado, LDC, and SDL. AMR has its basis at quite some time ago, maybe not quite 40 years, maybe more like 20 years ago, at ISI when Kevin was working with Bill Mann on machine translation. And the AMRs that we're building today are quite similar to the AMRs that were being built then. Kevin and Dan Gilday and Yin-Wen Shui and Kathy McEwen and I, did I get everybody? Yeah, have had an NSF grant for the last few years to work on semantics-based machine translation. And when Kevin realized that the PropBank annotations were giving him a large percentage of what he would want out of an abstract meaning representation, he decided to revive AMRs and has been pushing really hard to make all this happen. He wants simple structures like the PIN tree bank, but that are more semantic than syntactic. The goal is to support research in semantic parsing, natural language generation, and machine translation. The question is what content goes into the meaning representation. I mean, the goal is to be able to go from this is sort of the target for meaning-based machine translation, from the source string to some kind of source tree, perhaps a syntactic tree, perhaps a semantic tree. to a meaning representation, which can then map onto the target tree and the target string. And with AMRs, he's hoping to more or less collapse those three steps in the middle into one step. Here are a lot of different alternative semantic representations. They're really all just, they're all representing the same information. You can think of them as just different formatting choices. In fact, this right here is probably the closest to what Boxer outputs, for those of you who are familiar with Johann Bosch's Boxer. And we've spent some time comparing the Boxer output to the AMR output, and it's surprisingly similar. This is a representation that, as Kevin would put it, is very computer-friendly because it's a directed acyclic graph. This is a representation that is more human-friendly. So, of course, this is what AMRs are both. We have, this is what the annotators are annotating, what they deal with, but this is the underlying representation. The first guidelines were released in April 2012, based on 100 sentences from the Wall Street Journal and 244 web text sentences and The Little Prince, one of Kevin's favorite stories. We've now got, I think, about 13,000 sentences that have just been released through the DARPA DEFT program. And it is built quite to a large degree on PropBank. It's the basic who's doing what to whom representation, all in a single rooted structure. So for describe, for the PropBank annotation for describe, you'd have, here's the describe 01, you've got the arg 0, that's the describer, the arg 1, the thing described, and some sort of secondary attribute, what the thing is being described as. AMR does abstract away from the syntax more than PropBank does, and it also uses PropBank frame sets in ways that allow generalizations across the sentences that PropBank wouldn't have done. It's definitely moving a step more, closer to a real abstract representation. So AMR gives exactly the same representation for these three sentences. He described her as a genius. As he described her, she is a genius. His description of her, a genius. PropBank would give the same representation for the first one and the third one. The third one is just a nominalization. It's a different part of speech, but it's the same basic predicate argument structure. But it would do something different for the second one because it's two separate clauses. And so PropBank would actually have a representation of the B, the copula, in she is a genius. And then you'd have to do some sort of, you know, match inferencing or something to go from that to figure out that the genius fills the slot. So here's another example of the types of representations. So AMR would give the same representation to all three of these sentences. So the boy saw the girl who wanted him, the boy saw the girl who he was wanted by, the girl who wanted the boy was seen by him. Actually, so would PropBank, because these are just all active-passive variants, and you're moving one relative clause up to the top and so on. So this is one of Kevin's favorite slides. I had to include it. There are no verbs in AMR, and there are no nouns in AMR, and there are no adjectives or adverbs or affixes, and no zero pronouns or auxiliary verbs or copula verbs, and not very many prepositions. There's a few prepositions. So the idea is to abstract away from all the function words, the tense and aspect, the auxiliary verbs that point out tense and aspect and things like that, to just a common predicate argument structure. There are plans to include some of the tense and aspect information as feature values eventually, but we haven't started doing that yet. So here's another example. And this is something PropBank wouldn't do. So he was not aware of research on smokers. So this not aware of gets actually this realize frame set. So he did not realize there were smokers. And with a negative polarity, and that's again something, so PropBank just would mark the not as an argum neg and not do anything with it at all, but AMR gives it a representation. And then the he, and then the research, Again, this is a noun, but it is it can be considered an inventive noun, so it gets a predicate argument structure. And then smokers become persons who are arg zeros of smoking. So that's how a lot of relational nouns are dealt with. Not every single relational noun is dealt with like that, so we have a list. And Ulf has the editor is set up so that it gives you guidance on whether or not this is a particular relational noun where you would want to do this. And then what they smoke are cigarettes, and then named entities are handled very much like you'd like named entities to be handled. And in fact, these days we now have we're doing wikification, so there would actually be, since this is would link to the Kent, well, actually I guess it's just the Kent cigarette brand, but if it was the company that produced the Kent cigarette brand, then it would link to a DBpedia entry for that company. And here's a slightly longer sentence. John could not have heard about the professor's creation of the microbial viruses that Mary sold to Russia yesterday. So here we've got all of this in the domain because of the could of what's possible with a negative polarity, so it's not possible. So all of these modals get mapped onto some sort of a small list of modal predicates. And then, John is the person who's doing the hearing. What he's hearing about is the creation event, and the professor is doing the creating. What he's creating is this virus, which is modified by microbe, which is an arg zero of a selling event, and the agent of the selling event is Mary, and the country it's being sold to is Russia, and the time was yesterday. Yes?
Could I ask a question about time and tense and so forth? This is something that I was wondering about for some of the earlier ones as well. So I see that in general it looks like tense on the verbs hasn't been rendered, and I see that you could do that with additional time arguments, because when you have an explicit one, you say time yesterday, and maybe for a past tense verb, you could put in time past if you wanted. I'm wondering, why is it that only the selling has a time? How would you distinguish this from John could not possibly ever hear about the professor's creation?
So AMR wouldn't do very much in terms of distinguishing those things. The current AMR. One of the things we've been working on is we call it AMR 3.0, and we also call it RED for richer event descriptions, and we're doing temporal and causal relations between events, including marking them as with properties as being actual, hypothetical, or generic, and temporally ordering them with respect to the document time and the other events in the document. So that I'm hoping, knock on wood, to do a pilot maybe sometime this fall, once we've got enough AMRs with multi-sentence co-reference, where we would do that type of annotation on top of the AMRs. But we're not asking the annotators to do that as they're doing the AMRs. We really see that as being a two-pass thing, just because of the cognitive load. That they've got enough to keep in their heads right now while they're doing the AMRs. I don't think they could do it all at the same time.
Got it. Thanks for the clarification. In AMR,
Respect to tense in particular, like I said a few minutes ago, we will be adding future values to the predicates that include just like past, future, you know, some simple tense features.
So one inference from the sentence is that the creation is also in the past, and that it preceded the selling. It could be that in a translation of this AMR into another language, you don't nominalize create, and so you need to know it's in the past tense.
Yes.
In AMR 3.0, will create be marked as in the past as well?
Yes.
So the inferences are being marked.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay,
yeah.
Thanks.
So here are some more differences between PropInc and AMR. Here, let me go to this first. These are the types of semantic relations we can get in PropInc. And these were originally all just for the function tags on the what we call the argms, the argument modifiers, which are like adjuncts. We've now extended these so we all of the numbered arguments have these kind of function tags as well, so that you could, you know, if you wanted to look at just all of the manner arguments, whether they were, you know, sort of an inherent part of the verb or were considered more adjunct-like. We're sort of trying to blur the distinction between arguments and adjuncts and let people look at these things as coherent semantic subsets. But AMR has even more, lots more. And AMR also pays a lot more attention to quantities and date entities and time expressions. We're trying to do the time expressions in such a way that they're compatible with the time X's that people are using for temporal relations. And in particular, AMR has a lot of, let's see, there's some examples up here, of discourse relations. So compared to, cause, compared to, concession, condition. These are all discourse, things that are used to represent discourse connectors, very similarly to the way the PIN discourse tree bank does. So that's another important difference between AMRs and PropBank is that we're really, in addition to incorporating sort of named entity tagging and wikification as part of the whole structure, a single structure, we've also are adding the explicit predicate argument structures to represent the discourse connectives. And the PIN discourse tree bank does that just across sentences. It's intersentential. AMR does it as an intrasentential task. So again, that's something we need to kind of work on, making sure that the two things fit together coherently. So for this example, the House has voted to raise the ceiling to $3.1 trillion, but the Senate isn't expected to act until next week at the earliest. This would be considered, this but here gives you a contrast relationship between these two pieces. And then here, workers described clouds of blue dust that hung over parts of the factory, even though exhaust fans ventilated the area. This is a concession that you would hope this wouldn't be true, but we have to concede that it is in spite of our attempts. So it goes quite a bit further than PropBank by providing a lot more structuring of the noun phrases, including the named entities. It gives a lot more semantic relations between prepositional phrases and noun phrases in particular, but also more fine-grained distinctions for verb prepositional phrases. Does intrasentential coreference and intrasentential discourse relations. And it makes more extensive use of the PropBank predicates to collapse different ways of saying the same thing. And it gives an interpretation for negation and modality. So here's another example of something that AMR can do that PropBank wouldn't do. So here, gas could go to $10 a gallon. So this is for the could, the possible. And then the domain is go, this going event. And here, instead of just saying, so PropBank would just list gas as the thing that's going, as the arg zero of go. But AMR actually resolves the metonymy here, or the coercion, and tells you that it's the price of gas that's going to go to $10 a gallon. So it's sort of giving you, making explicit an implicit argument. It's hard to know where to draw the line on these implicit arguments. I have some more examples of that in a minute. So PropBank, we're right about to release, I keep saying about to release, I've been saying that for about 3 months now, haven't I, Tim? What we call the unified frame files. So there was a kind of an artificial distinction between PropBank and NonBank originally, where we had separate frame files for the nouns and for the verbs. So we're now unifying those. And so destruction and destroy will just be two different aliases for the same destroy frame file. And adjectives as well. We've been doing light verb constructions in PropBank for quite a while. We'll talk about that a little bit more in a minute, too. In fact, we'll talk about it right now. So things like do an investigation, have a seat, make an offer, take a walk, give a sigh. These are not, none of these are giving you two separate events. They're all just describing one event, and you want to represent that appropriately. So again, because of the distinction between prop bank and non-bank, there was kind of an uneasy connection between these two things, but we've been able to do it a bit more coherently now. So when the annotators are doing the annotation of the verb, like take, they have a light verb sense they can choose, which they do, and then we go back and do a second pass annotation on that expression where they look at the true predicate, the noun, or in some cases an adjective, and mark the arguments of the true predicate for the expression as a whole. And then there's the third pass is where it's done automatically, where you basically put the verb and the noun together as a, mark it as a multi-word expression. So to give you an example, you want the same annotation for your decision to say, look, I don't want to go through this anymore, as if you had said, I decided I don't want to go through this anymore, or you decided. And so here, the president made the fundamentally correct decision to get on offense. You want this to be the true predicate of this making expression. So the verb gets marked in the first pass, and then the second pass, this is the true predicate, and then all of the arguments are labeled. And we get very high agreement rates between the annotators for identifying these light verb constructions, but we've just realized that when Prague did their pass on the Wall Street Journal, they found a whole bunch of things that they called light verb constructions that we had not identified. So that's something we're going to be looking at as well. And there are, like, produce and issue would not be considered traditional light verbs. They're not like make, have, do, take. But produce an alteration, you really want to treat as a single altering event. Issue a complaint, you'd like to be a single complaining event. On the other hand, registering a complaint, maybe not. Maybe there's a little bit more going on there. So it can get, that in itself can get a bit challenging. So there's this SMATCH metric that's used to calculate agreement rates among the AMR annotators. And the annotation, actually, varies between about 73 for the web text and 83 for the Wall Street Journal. Web text is harder, a lot harder to do. PropBank annotation is a lot higher, but then it's a much simpler task. So you can think of the AMRs as being very similar to kind of dependency tree representations, except that they've abstracted away more from the surface syntax. They don't conclude the function words. Most of the nouns, and certainly the eventive nouns and adjectives, have all been given predicate argument structures with wikified named entities. There are abstract relations for discourse connectives. And some implicit arguments and relations have been made explicit, and the coreference, which is really important and is what makes it a graph rather than just a tree. I can skip that. I won't skip this. So, yes, go ahead. There's this whole SMATCH thing that sort of aligns the two different graphs and then compares each phrase. You can do kappas as well, but the kappas for this are going to be so low that who cares? yeah. Now this is more like just accuracy. Yeah. So there are a lot of decisions one of the biggest challenges of doing this, which is true for any kind of semantic annotation, but is perhaps especially true for this, is how do you define the boundaries? Do we treat this as a light, it's certainly a light verb expression. Do we map it onto the verb travel, even though trip and travel are not etymologically related? Initially, and the answer to that at the moment is yes, we are doing that. Initially, Kevin wanted to have the same representation for sentences that talked about desiring something and sentences that talked about wanting something. He wanted to sort of capture that semantic similarity in a common representation. But he's kind of backed off from that because unless the annotators, and you could, I mean, when they pull up the PropBank frame set for want or for desire, you could say to them, it could say, you know, use want. The desire frame set could say use want. And then they could do it consistently. But if you don't give them that in sort of, if that's not kind of figured out in advance for them, then they're gonna, you know, they could choose all kinds of different things. They might put want with wish instead of desire, or desire with wish, or, you know, that turned out to be sort of maybe harder to do than Kevin had originally anticipated. And at the moment, we've sort of backed off. And for the most part, we stick with things that are etymologically related, like fear, the verb, fear, the noun, and afraid. And these are all being encoded in the PropBank frame files. But it would be really nice to be able to go a step further and capture these kinds of semantic similarities. And again, this is where perhaps some of the automatic clustering techniques that are being done today, especially this is where I think the distributional compositional semantics could play a role in doing this kind of thing, you know, especially for specific applications, for specific domains, doing this kind of thing automatically so that you can bridge between the different representations. Okay, so let's go through an example then and see how much of this AMR, how many of the things that we want to get out of this AMR will give us, and if there are things that it won't. So Sato said that gorillas in one car opened fire on police standing guard, while a second car carrying 88 pounds of dynamite parked in front of the building, and a third car rushed the attackers away. Okay, so I've underlined all the sort of events. We want to make sure these things get predicate argument structures. So what about opening fire? Is that one event, or is that two events? How would you want to represent that? Do you want to have open as the verb and then have fire as some kind of argument to open? Do you want to treat it as a single expression? Do you want to maybe just have an underlying predicate for fire there? That is this the same thing as the gorillas fired on the police? Okay, so first you want to recognize the say event, okay, that this is all within a say. So your evidence for whether or not it's true depends on how much you believe the speaker. And then the open fire, you probably want to recognize that here opening is like starting. It's really like an aspectual verb. And so you just want the predicate to be fire. The gorillas are firing on the police. The police are who are being fired at. And then what about standing guard? It's not like standing a bottle on a table, is it? And I'm not sure, I meant to ask James about this and I forgot, if he thought this was aspectual or if it's just some kind of support verb. But you probably here want to say that it's just a guarding event and we don't know what's being guarded. Then we've got the carrying, and here you've got the question of, are they carrying the pounds or are they carrying the dynamite? What do you really want to be the head of this noun phrase? And then the parking, that the car is parking in front of the building. Is it really the car that's doing the parking? Do you want the car to be the agent of a parking event? We'll come back to that. And then finally, the third car rushes the attackers away. So there are, you quite often get implicit arguments. Here are some, you know, I'm gonna skip that. Let's just go cut to the chase here. You probably wanna recognize for this paragraph that the X here is the, you want to know what they were guarding. That's what's being attacked. It's probably the building. You may have enough information in the prior context to actually do a co-reference here. to fill that in. But perhaps more importantly, you also want to figure out that that the second car, when it got parked, had somebody driving it. Because the next thing you want to do, and this is where I would totally agree with David, that here the co-reference is one of the most important parts of understanding this sentence, is you want to figure out that the attackers are referring to not just the guerrillas who are opening fire, but also to the driver of the second car, because he didn't get left behind. In fact, that's what gives you the temporal ordering of these events. The only temporal marker you have is this while, which is just telling you that the standing guard, that the opening fire on the guards is happening sort of simultaneously or overlaps with the parking of the second car. But everybody who reads this knows that the third car can't rush away until that second car has been parked and the driver has gotten into the third car. And so the people being rushed away, the attackers, is referring to not just the guerrillas, but also this implicit driver of the second car. And then, of course, there's also a driver of the third car. So I don't know if you can read this. So this is the AMR, which Tim did for me this morning. And bless his heart, he had not seen this, my discussion about this particular example. He had no idea what I was planning to say about it. And I was very happy to see that he actually did, he did just do fire instead of open fire. So AMR would just give you the one predicate here. He also did just guard instead of standing guard. So we're getting the right predicate argument representations. But of course, one thing AMR wouldn't do at the moment is give you, make explicit the driver of the car. So the ARG1 is the thing being parked. So that's right. It's an ARG1, not an ARG0. Okay, it's not the agent of the parking. But does park have an ARG0? I hope. Huh? Yeah, so there's a missing ARG0 here. But at the moment, the AMR annotators aren't going to do anything with that. So that's another pilot that we're thinking about trying to do soon, is to see, you know, if the annotators can, if we can use the important arguments like ARG0s and ARG1s that are not currently present in the representation to sort of stimulate the annotators to retrieve these implicit arguments, and whether or not they can do it consistently. Is it a you know, well-defined task? So I'm kind of, I should be moving along, I think. Some more challenges that AMR doesn't address. Well, we talked about semantic similarity. And here's another example. So stock prices rose precipitously. The stock market leapt ahead. You'd like to somehow represent that these two things are really talking about the same kind of event. Maybe not on the same day, but if the stock market's leaping ahead, then it's the prices that are going up that's making you say that. That's maybe a more metaphorical description than the stock prices rising precipitously. But in order to do that, there's a lot that you've got to do. I mean, okay, fine, rise can refer to an increase of a scalar value. Leaping ahead, maybe metaphorically, could do the same thing. But you've still got to figure out that you need some world knowledge that tells you that the stock market is all about selling stocks, and the prices of the things that are being sold are very relevant to the stock market. And so when you're talking about the stock market and the stock prices, you could be talking about the same kind of thing. So there's a lot, you've got a metaphorical interpretation, you've got a lot of world knowledge going on here. This is, I don't even have any ideas about pilots for how to do this kind of thing right now. If anybody has any suggestions, or if you know, maybe this is where distributional compositional semantics can come to the rescue, I'd be happy to hear that too. Yes, Jason.
Do you want to take discourse context into account when interpreting the sentences?
Oh, yes, absolutely.
I mean, stock prices in some context might mean specifically telecommunication stocks. And the fact that those prices went up doesn't mean that the stock market as a whole went up.
Yeah. So, but absence of any context to tell you that the stock prices are just for a particular stock, then I think you would assume it was the market as a whole.
But you'd annotate it differently in different contexts?
Well, at the moment, we would just say that the prices are rising, and we wouldn't try to say anything at all about whether it's the whole stock market or not. So that's exactly the kind of thing that you would need to make decisions about if you were going to try to annotate it. So, yes, so maybe this is something we should talk about. And here's another thing that, so this is an example of a cause motion construction that at the moment AMR wouldn't be doing anything with. So they threw him out of the university. Okay, he left the university, right? We all understand that, no problem. They hissed him out of the university. He also left the university. So here's what Google Translate gives you if you're translating it into Spanish. So, I can't even see this. Ellos le echaron fuera de la universidad. Okay, fine. They basically threw him out of university. And then la cibo fuera de la universidad. They whistled to him outside the university. So it doesn't mean the same thing at all. And it's the sort of thing that's going to be hard for, you know, sort of standard current machine translation systems to handle. And at the moment, AMR isn't really doing anything with that either. Although we are planning, in fact, to add these kinds of constructions as PropBank frame files. We're adding them to VerbNet as VerbNet classes, and then we're going to try to figure out how to do the same thing with PropBank so that the annotators can recognize what the meaning is when you get this kind of cause motion construction with verbs that are normally considered intransitive. Here's another new usage. This one really got me. I just saw it for the first time the other day. Not all yarn frogs easily. Frogs is the verb. And it has to do with unpicking knitting that you've already knitted. And in fact, I think it means ripping it out, basically. And there's another word, tink, which is knit spelled backwards, which is if you very carefully unravel the knitting stitch by stitch. And certain kinds of yarn, are harder to frog than other kinds of yarn. I don't think we have a PropBank frame file for frog as a verb. I don't believe. So here's another one that I quite like. The curtain. So here's fall. The curtain fell on the diva. His cigarette ash fell on the diva's skirt. These would both map to fall.01, just a basic kind of descend. The curtain's coming down. The ash is coming down. And it does not in any way acknowledge that what happens when the curtain comes down is the top of the curtain stays attached, and what you're doing is dropping the bottom of the curtain. In fact, if anything, you're creating kind of a barrier between the audience and the diva who's still on stage. And then we get, by the time the Iron Curtain fell in 1989, differences ran deep indeed. Now, if it had said, now somebody tell me, I meant to Google this morning and I forgot, when would you say the Iron Curtain went into place? 1950s? 1960? As late as that, really? I'm thinking late 48, 49, 50, somewhere right around then. Okay. Huh? 61? Okay. That was when the Berlin Wall was, okay. All right, we'll take 1961. So if this sentence had been, by the time the Iron Curtain fell in 1961, differences ran deep indeed, then you would want to get the curtain fell interpretation. Right? And it is a curtain. So if it's a curtain falling, you'd expect it to be the same interpretation. But because it says 1989, what we really want to say is that it collapsed. So it wasn't attached at the top. It was there. The curtain was there as a barrier, and it collapsed. Yes, right. And AMR is not going to address that. PropBank's not going to address that. Yes.
I just want to point out that these two events, the Iron Curtain falling in the first sense and the Iron Curtain falling in the second sense, are high frequency items in
yes.
literature.
Yes.
So another interpretation is this is just a reference resolution.
Okay, great. That's wonderful. And in fact, yeah, it's the real world knowledge. It's the 1989 can maybe help you identify this event rather than another one. Thank you so much. I really like that answer. So I could do a tool demo. What I have here are Dan's slides, I think. Did you use those slides I sent you? Yes, okay. From the first day, that talk a little bit more about sort of AMRs and machine translation. So I could run through those again if anybody wants to see them again now that you've learned more than you ever wanted to know about AMRs. Or I could just stop and take questions. So it's kind of up to you guys. So this just one point here that we have looked at trying to align as much as possible dependency tree parses of English and Chinese, and in particular subtrees of those parses, just seeing how many of those subtrees actually line up isomorphically with the subtree in the target language sentence. And we got maybe about 30%. It was very discouraging. The student who was working on this, do you remember Yuan Ding? It was one of my best students. He came to do a PhD to solve machine translation. When he realized how little the syntax was going to help, he finished his PhD and went to Wall Street. And he's making lots more money than I am, but I still wish he was working on machine translation. But when we did the alignment of the parallel propping structures across English and Chinese, and this was before we had nearly as many nouns as we have now, we got almost 60% alignment. So we were, you know, just the propping by itself does a lot of abstraction away from the surface syntax and is giving you, you know, structures that are more similar. So we're hoping that the AMRs will align even more. And that's kind of what we're looking at over the next few weeks here in this workshop, looking at Czech English and Chinese English. There are lots of questions we have. We want to know. Where Andrzej in particular is looking at trying to map the tectogrammatical representation, which is yet another variant. I should really have had tectogrammatical up there too as a possible semantic representation, trying to automatically convert that to AMR, because think of all the parallel data that would immediately hand Dan and David for their machine translation systems. And so we're looking at the similarities and differences between doing this mapping. How hard is that going to be? Since they've already done a lot of work on looking at the prop bank as compared to the English valency lexicon in Czech, there's kind of a head start on that. We were looking at the actual AMRs themselves, how distant and how similar are they? And we want to know which of the differences are going to screw up the graph matching the most. So which are the things that we should be prioritizing? And there are a lot of places where in AMRs you can make a choice, like whether or not to reify. I have an example of that. And so if you could either reify this or not reify it, can we produce the alternatives deterministically, the one that does the reification and the one that doesn't? And then that would maybe allow the AMRs to match the other languages a bit better. So we've done at least 100 sentences in all three languages. We had a paper at ELRIC where we talked about the differences. Ulf Hermjakob has taken the Antonots annotation, which includes coreference and named entities in PropBank, and automatically converted that to AMRs. Of course, they're not all exactly the way people would have done them, but you know, that's one source of parallel data we can look at. And some of that, we have English-Chinese parallel data for some of that. So these trees are really kind of hard to read. And I don't have much time. So why don't I leave this? If you have questions about this, I'm happy to go back to it. But like I said, some of the choices are things like whether or not you should reify. And then there are lexical choices. And then there's some things that are just, we could have reified the English. Okay, and then there are just lexical differences. Languages just choose to express things in different ways, either with multi-word expressions or not multi-word expressions or different numbers of arguments and things like that. So we're looking at kind of all of these different things. And that's really all I have to say.
Dan. Let's take a few more questions.
Yeah.
So this is really fascinating. You've got a really interesting kind of cluster of questions. So it's hard to pick one. Let me. So I'm just wondering how much could you get away with not having some of the rich language understanding that you mentioned for the purpose of machine translation? And what I'm thinking is...
Oh, you mean the challenges AMR doesn't address?
Some of the things
well,
that you said AMR doesn't address.
Yes, hopefully
so
a whole lot of
for example,
it.
The example about the stock market. Really, I was sitting there wondering if I was, as a person who's done quite a lot of translation myself, so if you look at like, you know, Fagan's and Lattimore's translations of the Odyssey and the Iliad, right? They have extremely different translation styles,
yeah.
And basically what the difference between them is that Fagan is trying to kind of soak in the deep meaning that a Greek listener to the oral mm-hmm. poetry would have experienced and try to reproduce it in his English-speaking readers. And what Lattimore is trying to do is take each phrase and translate it into something that can, you know, ideally each word, you know, appropriately
yeah.
translated into
yeah.
some sense yeah. of English and allow you to feel kind of more the internal structure of the Greek.
Yep.
And
the
you know,
poetry.
He deviates from that when it would give you something that was ungrammatical or otherwise nonsensical in English, but minimally. And so this is a sort of different translation style. And I mean, I guess if we had super rich language understanding, maybe we could be Fagan, but maybe it's okay to be Lattimore, you know?
Yes. No, in fact, when we first translated, we got the Xinhua News, which was the original 250K Chinese tree bank. We had half of it translated into English, and I gave very specific instructions to do word for word, to do, what did you say, Lattimore was the,
yeah,
totally literal, as literal as possible, and yet still trying to maintain English fluency. That turned out to be more of a challenge than we'd realized, and we spent another year and a half hand correcting the English. But absolutely, as far as the computer's concerned, I think Lattimore's the way to go. And I mean, I wasn't really expecting AMR to solve all of these problems, but I guess I wanted to make the point that there, you know, if we ever did want the computer to translate War and Peace, we might need to be able to address some of those things. But I'm not sure that we need the, you know, that that's the goal that we should have.
So, nice talk. I just had a question about ambiguity. So whenever you're doing annotation, you come to these boundary cases, whether open fire is one or two events,
yeah.
or whether,
yes.
You know, and some of the other examples you showed. And I wonder if, you know, if we're trying to capture meaning, part of the meaning is this gradation, and maybe instead of having just one, annotation, you know, you get, maybe 10 utterances and look at the distribution of what people decide, and that tells you, how much of an event this is versus two.
Yeah. So. Yes, I totally get that.
I know
and
there's annotation costs involved.
When we do the word sense annotation, we save we always keep the original, we do double annotation for the word sense tagging, and then we do adjudication of any discrepancies, but we always keep the original annotations. And so that, and the goal, and I've a couple people have asked me for this, and I need to give it to them. But the idea was that you might want to go back and look at which were the examples that were the most confusing for the annotators. We allow the annotators to give more than one word sense if they feel like it's, you know, a sort of systematic ambiguity that should, you know, that there are really two possible senses here. So we do try, you know, to acknowledge that. As the linguist in me really wants to keep track of all of that stuff. The computer scientist in me wants to give the machine learning systems data that's as consistent as possible. Especially at this point when we're still kind of struggling with getting this stuff right. But in the long run, I think it would be, I mean, that's actually one of the reasons that we want, what we want to do, look at over the next few weeks is what are the kind of alternative sort of AMR structures that are more or less semantically equivalent for the same sentence? And do any of those match the, you know, the target sentence AMR better than maybe the first one that we did? So it's just trying to figure out how to have our cake and eat it too with respect to this, you know, sort of wanting to preserve the goal of good training data and yet also wanting to allow for variations.
I'm wondering, you mentioned that you're hoping that compositional vector space semantics will be helpful, and I'm wondering if what that hope consists in, because in fact the work that's been done empirically testing it to date has, they've been testing against each other, and in which case there's improvements, but in absolute terms, the success rate of, as measured by, say, Pearson correlations with human judgments on similarity is quite low.
Yeah.
I mean, we're talking about on the edge of statistical significance. And that might be, of course, this is, we don't know, but it might be because the compositional vector value is not really transparent for distribution of its constituents,
right.
In which case it's not getting what you want it to get.
Well, so there are some approaches, and I think the Oxford approach and what, in particular Marco Borroni, mm-hmm. and Katrin Erk, that with Ray Mooney, this kind of they're paying more attention to kind of the predicate argument structures. So I think that's a very important direction to go. And I also, and this is my personal bias, I think it might be useful to try sense tagging the data and then doing different senses, producing different vectors for the different senses, and seeing if we could get kind of, you know, more interesting judgments that way. And I don't care. This is my bias. I'm not really interested in a vector representation of a whole sentence. I want the vector representations of the predicate argument structures. And I think those could be useful. And we might be able to cluster them, especially if they... And so I'd say that I'd start with doing the sense tagging first and then doing the vector representations. In the long run, I'd like them to be able to do that, make those sense distinctions automatically. Okay,
At the lexical level, vector space semantics was created to
yeah.
do things like listening.
Exactly, yeah. And so they should be, you know, eventually able to make better distinctions than I'm making automatically. And then I just want little clusters of for the predicate argument structures that are where they are in the same semantic space. But I think we also need to do more with the arguments themselves. I mean, we probably, you know, never mind. I mean, there's a lot to do.
So another thing I was wondering was if I was trying to take this, you know, so you talked less about what you do with the AMRs and the other direction. Than about how to get them in the first place. So I'm just thinking about that example of translation into Spanish, which was really interesting. But one of the things that was interesting about it was the attempted rendering is just ungrammatical in Spanish, right? So I can't coerce a manner verb into a motion interpretation
yes.
in Spanish. So I can't, it's ungrammatical to say something like, he whistled across the hall. I have to say he went across the hall whistling.
Yeah, no, what you want to say in Spanish is something like maybe they threw him out of the university by hissing at him.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
So where did those kinds
or
of...
Or even they forced him out of the university by hissing at him.
So where would those kinds of constraints, the things you know independently about Spanish, come in once you've got the AMR built up for English?
Well, then I think we'd have to look at AMRs for Spanish and where there are systematic differences. And we do know things like, you know, verb-centered languages and satellite-centered languages, and you know, so we can anticipate what some of these systematic differences are going to be. So those are some of the kinds of things we're going to be looking for with respect to Czech English and Chinese English when we're right in the next few weeks.
Okay, well, thanks very much, Martha. That's very cool.